One of the ways the English dealt with social change as the Industrial Age took hold was by learning from writers like Jane Austen, who wove social commentary into their novels. Today, we're celebrating the 200th anniversary of the publication of Jane Austen's first novel. The title page read, Sense and Sensibility, a novel in three volumes by a lady. Today, we're paying tribute to this remarkably influential novelist of Regency England with the help of Andrew Davis. He's known for his adaptation of Austen's Pride and Prejudice for the BBC in 1995. That's the miniseries in which Cullen Firth defined the role of Mr. Darcy for British and American TV viewers. Davis also wrote the screenplay for Bridget Jones' Diary, which recast Firth as a modern-day Mr. Darcy. Apologies in advance in case the audio quality in our connection to Mr. Davis is not as clear as it might be. It's a digital compatibility issue with the older equipment connecting us to the BBC studios in Coventry. I find it ironic that our technology is not quite up to snuff during an interview about a 19th century author who relied solely on pen and paper. I imagine Miss Austen would have also found this rather droll. Mr. Davis, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Now, you have really had an impact on the British understanding of Jane Austen's work, and it has crossed the Atlantic with the ease of the Beatles, it seems like. What's your take on that? Did it surprise you how America got all excited about your work on Jane Austen?
I guess it did a little bit, because I always think of you Americans, you have your own classics, Little Women, that kind of thing, Last of the Mohicans, and I was delighted that Jane Austen went over so well. But I think really what I was trying to do very much with the adaptations was to kind of show people that Jane Austen characters weren't just sort of stuffy historical figures. They were live, breathing human beings just like you and me with very much the same kind of preoccupations. She writes about things that never go out of fashion, love and sex and money and conflict between the generations and friendship and breaking friendship and all those things that are ever so easy to understand. They're very real all the time, and they lock into the deepest interests of readers or viewers. And the thing about why do somebody wrote 200 years ago, the thing was she just did it so well. Her characters are so vivid and so real and so lovable. So I've always been a terrific Jane Austen fan, ever since I was made to read her at school when I was about 15 or 16.
Well, you know, she wasn't really an exceptional person as far as power or money or things like that. I understand she died when she was 41. She had written three novels by the time she was 23. She was essentially homeschooled. We don't know a lot about her, but who was Jane Austen?
Oh, that's absolutely right. She spent a very quiet life. She had quite an interesting family. They were gentry, but they weren't very well off. Two of her brothers went into the Navy, and one of them became an admiral, so they did very well. She had another brother who was a lawyer. So there was plenty of experience that she gained from them, even though she herself, you could say, had very little experience. She never got married. She was proposed to once or twice, but the guy that she really liked never did get around to proposing. He ran off to Ireland. And in fact, she was never too much of a catch because she couldn't bring much money to the marriage. She was a bit like the sisters in Pride and Prejudice in that respect, but rather more unlucky in terms of love and marriage.
Is there a lot of autobiography in her work?
I think there's bound to be quite a bit. Of course, she changes it and so on. But she had a lot of this experience of living in quite a remote part of the country where there weren't very many people at all. There were only about 6 or 10 families within visiting reach. And so if anybody interesting came to stay from London, that was very, very exciting.
Wow.
Because it might be a marriage prospect or it might be somebody who'd change the family fortunes. But in Jane Austen's case, she lived more or less in the same place all her life. She spent a bit of time in Bath. She spent a bit of time in Winchester. But mostly it was with a very small circle.
Well, people have, you know, different ruffles on their sleeves and different sorts of entertainment and different sorts of trappings. But there's some timeless things about this, you know, especially a young woman. And I think women find Jane Austen's work particularly meaningful. Is it just she was really good at relating to the frustrations of a woman trying to break through class barriers or be taken seriously, even though she didn't have a lot of money?
That was part of it. That was very much part of it. Sense and Sensibility just still feels awfully modern to me. It's about two sisters. One of them is a bit too cautious, and the other one is quite reckless emotionally. And so one of them holds back too much to show that she loves the guy that she really wants to marry. The other one falls head over heels in love with a guy who turns out to be totally unreliable. But they have to spend such a lot of time, the lives of girls, they weren't allowed to do anything much, and they're always hanging around on the telephone waiting to hear if he'll call. Of course, they didn't have telephones in those days. They had to wait for a letter, you know.
They can relate. It's a timeless thing.
They say, why did he go away? When will he come back? We haven't heard from him. And then when he did turn up, he seemed strangely put out. What's the matter? Did I do something wrong? And there's all those kind of concerns going on, modern girls can relate to.
I can
so
just
much.
See Jane Austen sitting at Starbucks waiting for a text message
exactly.
from the guy who's
exactly.
not paying attention to her.
Exactly. That's the kind of thing. That's the kind of thing. And something like Northanger Abbey is about a very young girl. She's 17. She's going to Bath for the first time. And she goes into the assembly rooms, which is just like, I don't know, going to a disco or going to a club. And it's absolutely crowded with strangers and exciting-looking young men. And she doesn't know who are the goodies and who are the baddies. And it just appeals so much. I used to be a school teacher, and I used to teach it to 13, 14-year-old girls. And once they'd got over the slight difference in the language, they absolutely lapped it up because it was like their lives.
You know, Bath is such a great rack upon which to hang all of these stories, isn't it? Bath was just the showcase city. It was the place people went to really make the scene.
Very much, and it could be quite a dangerous sort of place, because in Jane Austen's own world and the world of most of these girls coming from country families, if they were at home, they'd only meet people that their parents knew. But going to Bath, there was a kind of freedom and license about the place, so that strangers could introduce themselves or be introduced by the master of ceremonies, but you never knew whether you were meeting an honourable suitor or a complete cad who was after your money or, even worse, after your virtue.
Bath is even built for that. Bath has sidewalks that are bigger than the streets, I believe, designed so people could promenade.
Absolutely, and lots of little alleys that you could sneak off down and have private conversations without your mother and your aunt noticing. So it's very, very exciting place. And something as big and grand as the assembly rooms must have been just so exciting for, you know, a sheltered young girl who's only lived in a little village in the country.
In those days, people could dress up in a way that would enable them to present a false persona.
Yes, that's true. I mean, there was a lot of posing going on and pretending that you came from a grander family than you really did and that kind of thing, and making a little money go a long way.
The whole class thing is so fascinating, I think, to Americans, because we make a point to try not to be bogged down by that. Whether we are or not is another discussion. But in England, the class thing was, it dictated so much, especially in Jane Austen's time, didn't it? And her brother was able to sort of navigate through the social class constraints because he got fast-tracked as a officer in the British Navy.
Yes, that was one way. Jane Austen was always very proud of, she was a gentleman's daughter, and all her main characters, they will all say they're gentlemen's daughters, but often they don't have much money, and that was Jane Austen's own case. Her father didn't have very much money at all, and her brothers had the good fortune, really, to go into the Navy, not get killed, but at the time of the Napoleonic Wars, when you could not only progress through the ranks, but through the prize money that you got for capturing French battleships and that kind of thing. naval officers could be extremely rich. Yeah, you never hear anything about the Napoleonic Wars in Jane Austen's novels.
But this was the same time, wasn't it?
It was at the same time.
The whole career was coinciding with all of this French threat to Britain and Admiral Nelson and all of that sort of stuff. And
absolutely.
So it's a parallel world. It was probably a huge thing in Jane Austen's mind, but she's got it intimate down to a girl's struggles and frustrations in the countryside of England.
Yes, that's true. In fact, the Navy and the war does come in, obviously no war scenes, but in her last novel, Persuasion, the hero who eventually marries the heroine is just such one of these people. He's a naval officer who's making his way slowly in the Navy and becoming a success. And he's somebody who the heroine's snobby relations had looked down on because he doesn't come from a grand family. But by the end of the war, he's richer than any of them because of all the prize money that he's earned.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about Jane Austen. 2011 is the 200th anniversary of the publication of her first book, Sense and Sensibility. And Andrew Davis is the man who wrote the screenplay for the BBC series Pride and Prejudice. And he also wrote the screenplay for the movie Bridget Jones' Diary. Andrew, of course, 2011 is a big year for Janeites, I guess we call people who are really into Jane Austen. This is a travel show, after all. Let's talk a little bit about sightseeing in England, if you're a fan of Jane Austen or you want to be.
Oh, well, you should certainly go to Bath if you're a fan of Jane Austen. You should go to see where Jane Austen lived towards the end of her life, Chawton Cottage in Hampshire, which has been preserved as a little Jane Austen museum. And you'll be able to see the tiny little sitting rooms that she worked in with the rest of the family around her, and really very, very kind of cramped conditions. But it's really worth seeing. And I guess the other thing is you should probably go and see some of the grand country houses of England, somewhere like Lyme Park, which was where they shot Pride and Prejudice, and gives a very good idea of what Pemberley would have been like, which was where Darcy lived, where Colin Firth did his hunting, shooting and fishing.
Andrew, what if I said, sure, you can see her lock of hair here, and you can see her desk at the British Library, and you can go to the town where she lived or something, but you would really find the most rewarding travel experience by going to Bath and putting yourself in an 1810 mindset and just trying to let the whole town be a time tunnel experience for you so you can just sort of get into a Jane Austen perspective. Does that make any sense to you?
I think it does, because Bath is a perfectly preserved Regency spa town. And for real Jane Austen fans, the novel, both Persuasion and Northanger Abbey, are set there or partly set there. And you can give yourself a Jane Austen walk because the actual streets are mentioned. My wife and I actually spent our honeymoon in Bath and stayed in a hotel in Milsom Street, which is where Catherine Morland had her lodgings in Northanger Abbey. And you can go to the assembly rooms and you can go to the baths and
The assembly rooms themselves are incredible. You've got your string quartet, you've got your Bath buns, you've got Beau Nash looking down on you, you've got this incredible ambience. And you can drink that horrible water that they've been drinking for 2,000 years there.
Yes, it's not very nice, is it? But it's said to do you good.
They say so, yeah. I think one of the most vivid attractions in Bath might be, well, two things. Number one, Royal Crescent, which is a house from the neoclassical age, perfectly preserved. Have you been in that Georgian house?
Yes, I have. And I think you can actually stay in the Royal Crescent, can't you?
There's a hotel there on the Royal Crescent, which is quite pricey, but you can go there for tea, which is accessible to anybody out in the garden in the back.
That would be the thing to do, I guess.
But there's one house, as there are in York and in Edinburgh and many places in England, that really is just a perfect Georgian mansion with all sorts of volunteers in each room to describe all the social silliness and challenges and restraints that people lived with 200 years ago in England. Also in Bath, there is the best costume museum I've found anywhere in Europe, and it takes you several centuries of the evolution of fashion one decade at a time. And of course, all the fashions of Jane Austen's time would be right there in that beautiful costume museum, which is associated with all of these Jane Austen era sites. I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Andrew Davis from Coventry in England about Jane Austen. Andrew, what are your concerns and challenges in being true to Jane Austen? Would she be happy with seeing what you do on TV or in a movie theater?
I hope she would. In general, I don't change very much because her plots are pretty much perfect and her dialogue is very good. It's just a question of crystallizing it and trimming it down. What I do, though, that I'm not sure whether she'd approve of, is that I wrote some of the scenes that she decided not to write, because she would never write scenes with men on their own or men with other men, because she said, I've never had those experiences, so how would I know? But with something like Pride and Prejudice, I wanted the viewers to get to know Darcy and sympathise with him a bit. So I wrote quite a lot of scenes with Darcy and his friend Bingley galloping about on horses, and also try to make Darcy seem a lot more human with scenes like Darcy getting dressed, Darcy having a bath, Darcy diving in the lake, which gave us the famous wet shirt scene.
Whoa, so you had the delight as a writer to be sort of in a dance with Jane Austen.
That's a very good way of putting it, yeah.
And yeah. She did the woman's perspective, and for the context for the 21st century viewer, you got to give the man's perspective.
Yeah, that was what I tried to do, yes.
And today, as people both in Britain and the United States enjoy your work and enjoy Jane Austen's work through your work, what meaning do you hope for people to gain from this time tunnel experience back to England 200 years ago?
Well, I think one of the things that comes most strongly through Jane Austen's work is this feeling that you need to be true to yourself, and things should come out right. If they don't come out right, well, you can't rebuke yourself. At least you've done the right thing. I mean, she's very much in favor of virtues like sincerity and honesty and being true to your own feelings and being kind and being generous. And don't want to make her seem too much of a goody-goody, because she's very sharp and witty as well. I think, you know, you can actually get quite a good moral education out of reading the books of Jane Austen.
Andrew Davis, next time I go to Bath, England, I think, thanks to your inspiration, I'll factor in a little more Jane Austen sense and sensibility.
Great, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Each year, Rick Steves tour guides take free-spirited travelers on escorted tours through England, Scotland, Ireland, and beyond, one small group at a time. This year, we're featuring tours of the best of Ireland, the best of Scotland, the best of England, and London. For a free catalogue and Rick's Tour Experience DVD, visit the tour pages at ricksteves.com.